Our third means of growing our business is to increase the actual sales per purchase. As with our other strategies, we're again limited only by our creativity and imagination. Let's go over some ways that we can do this. I'll start off with a brief example of how the grocery or the food industry does this. Lots of their customers, unfortunately, don't like it, and I think you'll understand in a moment why. They do it in what we call a reversed fashion. Instead of increasing their price, they package their products with less content. In other words, they're selling less for the same price. They feel that it's easier to do that than increase the actual price itself. That's why when you get a 12-inch bag of potato chips and once you open it up, it's only about 2 inches full. Less pickles in the jar, less diapers in the package, less everything, but the price stays the same. Now, is it legal? Yes, it is. Why? It's legal as long as they put the weight and the cost on the package. So this is just one example of increasing the actual sale per purchase. Maybe some people don't think that one is an ethical way of doing it, but it is legal. I came up with the next example as a way to upsell or generate more revenue from my client's initial purchase when I had my jewelry store. We often had people come in to have their wedding rings designed. We might have them bring in a picture or a drawing to have us design exactly what they wanted. Now, before their design was made in gold, we first made it into a wax carving. From that, a molded flask was made, and then we heated that up, and the gold was actually melted and poured into that flask. Pouring the gold in the flask where the ring was really wasn't that difficult to do, and it was very exciting to watch if you had never seen that before. You light a torch and a big flame melts the raw gold into a liquid, and then it's poured into the flask, and in minutes after the pouring, ta-da, your ring was in solid gold. We figured that people might be interested in wanting to watch that, and they might be interested in melting and pouring the gold themselves. It would be a really neat experience for them. So what we proposed to do was to teach them how to do this, and while we were teaching them how to do this, we would actually take their pictures of them pouring the gold, and that could be placed in their wedding album. Well, would it work, and more importantly, would people pay extra to do this? The answer was yes. We were the only one that offered such a program, and I think even till today, I haven't heard of anyone doing anything like this. We could make an extra $100 or $200 per sale depending on how involved the person wanted to get. Simple idea, but effective. So if we could get 10 clients a month that wanted to do this, that's another $1,000 to $2,000 extra dollars a month that would actually cost us nothing to generate. Some companies offer extra warranties or insurance when you purchase a product. There are ways to increase the sales. We just have to always look for ways. You can also repackage what you sell. That's really what we're wanting to talk about. Upselling, that's another way too. But can you repackage what you sell? Let me share with you an idea on how we do this. Sometimes we'll have an offer where when you purchase one of our products, we'll offer you another at a substantial discount. Now, many times people will take advantage of that offer, which in turn will increase our sales. It convinces, if you will, a customer to spend more because of how we've packaged that offer. The additional program that they purchased would have cost them more if they chose to purchase it separately because of the way we packaged it and gave the substantial discount to that second program. It increased our sale, plus it encouraged the customer to spend more money. Many of your major fast food restaurants are experts at doing this. Just about all of them do it. They take this to incredible levels. They'll do a joint venture with a movie. They'll offer toys or cartoon characters for free or collector items for an additional $1.99 with a meal. Then they won't make the collector items available all at one time. You know, they'll spread it over a period of time, sometimes over many months. This causes the customer to hang in there and wait till the next one is released so they come back again and again. Smart marketing tools, don't you think? So basically, they're doing really two things here. They're repackaging their product and how they sell them so they can increase their sales. And sometimes because they make their collector items available over a certain amount of period of time or several months, they're extending the shelf life and creating loyalty with that customer. Many of these restaurants do extensive studies so that they can repackage what they sell to maximize their profits. For example, let's say a restaurant studies their sales and they find out that on average the best-selling items per purchase are a medium hamburger for $2, a medium soda for 80 cents, and medium fries for $1. I'm obviously making these prices up. So that'll give us now a grand total for this purchase of $3.80. Then they try to get the average customer who purchases these three foods to spend more money. To do this, they might create a package or offer a special price, and here's what I'm talking about. They might offer a large burger instead of a medium burger. medium soda, and large fries instead of small fries for $4.80. Now, their study shows that they're not selling as many large burgers and large fries as they would like to. It becomes a special price because if the customer purchased the large burger, the soda, and large fries by themselves, the total would be $5.80. But now, because of the special pricing, they're offering it for $4.80. So if all three of these items were purchased separately, that comes to an extra dollar for the larger burger, an extra dollar for the larger fries. Their profit margins show that it's worth it for them to make a special price and take a dollar off of the entire package. Instead of the $5.80, it's $4.80. Now, just by the way they package their product, they increase their sales by an extra dollar. A dollar may not sound like much, but if you multiply that by millions of large burger and french fry sales, it really adds up, doesn't it? Always keep in mind, too, when you repackage a product and add more products to something that you want to increase the sales, like the extra fries or whatever you're selling, you don't always have to offer a special price. A lot of it can be just in how you repackage what you're selling. Let's review these three important ways to grow your business and increase revenue. The first is to increase your volume of customers. Think outside of the box. Advertising is one way, but that many times is obviously easy, which is okay, but it's also very expensive. Consider doing joint ventures, get referrals, and create promotions. And when you think you've come up with some great ways to do this, think again and again and again. The second is to extend the shelf life or the amount of times your customer purchases from you. Now, I find this strategy to be one of the most enjoyable. Why? Because it's endless with what you can do here. To make this work for you, you must know who your customers are, what they want, and you must gather their information. So collect addresses and emails. The third point that we just discussed was to increase the total amount of the individual purchases. Repackage your product or service or try to upsell. Increase that initial purchase. It's obvious that none of this can be done without the customer. Customers are such a valuable asset. Unfortunately, treating the customer with care seems to be a thing of the past for many companies, don't you think? How do you handle customers, especially those who are experiencing problems with your product or service? Hopefully, the exact same way you would want them to treat you. When I first got started in business, I used to hear the saying, "The customer is always right." And I tried my best to live up to that saying and soon found out that I really didn't believe that. Do you? Now, wait a minute, don't answer that yet. If you sold a product, let's say a car, and the customer came back 4 months later and put 12,000 miles on that car and demanded to have their money back because they didn't like, say, the color, would you give them their money back? Now, of course, I'm going a little overboard here, but remember, the customer is always right. But still in this example, would you give the customer their money back? I wouldn't think so. So then, where do we draw the line? There must be a balance. Now, I'm a firm believer in trying to make the customer feel that they are always right. Big difference, isn't there? Too often, when a customer has a problem, the person they are venting it to often becomes very defensive. The moment we get defensive, we've blown it. I try to choose the right people in my company to take care of customer problems. I'm looking for someone who is overall a sympathetic person, not a pushover though, someone who knows where to draw the line. Now, some customers will take advantage of you if they can or if you let them. We still have to be firm with them and at the same time also be sympathetic to their needs and problems. But they are not always right. So no, I don't believe that the customer is always right. I know when the shoes are switched and I'm the customer and I have a problem with the purchase, I'm not always right. We have to find that balance. I strongly believe that a customer should be treated as if they're your only one. Without customers, all of our companies are worthless. We have to treat customers like gold. Sometimes, as salespeople, we forget to realize what really goes on in the minds of our customers. When we talk to them, we focus on selling that product, and we have a tendency at times to, get so wrapped up in the selling process. But have you ever stopped to think about what that customer is going to say about you, about your company and your product when they're not in front of you, when they leave your establishment, whether they bought something from you or not? Now stop and think about how often you and your friends engage in conversations about a product or a service or a company. It's probably a lot more than you think or realize. Let's say a group of you go to dinner, and after you leave, you say something like, boy, that steak was great, or the food was cold, or the service stunk, or the service was great. Maybe a week later, another friend calls you and wants to know if you would like to go out with them and have a bite, and if you have any recommendations. Let's assume that the place that you ate at last week was horrific. Do you think your experience now might come up in that conversation? I would think so. Well, whatever we do, make sure we don't go back to that restaurant. Not only might we say that, but we'll go through the whole ordeal in great detail and explain every bad thing that happened. You ever done that before? Or know somebody who's explained bad experiences about going to a company to you? Absolutely. Now, if we behave in this manner as customers, isn't it only logical for our customers to react exactly the same way, or maybe even worse? You bet. We must think about this. Our customers or potential customers are going to talk when they're not around us. We personally have a lot of control as to what they say about us, whether it be good or bad. Now, when I find a business that I thought was good or bad, I try to have some of my associates go to that establishment so they can understand and feel what it's like to be treated like royalty or like trash, depending on how the business treats their customer. Businesses lose so much money because they're not taking care of the customer. Now, I have some friends who come to me and explain that their business is slow and bad, and unfortunately, I know how they run their business and I can understand why. Many times they're very rude to their customers. We have to think beyond the profit of one sale. We must consider the shelf life or long-term value of that customer. I recently spent a considerable amount of money purchasing some electronic equipment, and unfortunately, my buying experience was not very pleasant. I had to make at least 3 or 4 trips back to the store to exchange some of the items that didn't work. The store was about an hour away from the office, so every visit cost me at least 3 hours of time round trip, not including getting into the store and doing what I had to do. That's a lot of wasted time. I was dealt with so poorly that I was compelled to take one of my associates with me so they could observe how never to treat a customer. I had my associate call the store 2 days in advance to make sure the items that I had to exchange were in. The salesperson said yes. We told him what time we were going to arrive. So we made our hour drive, and the salesperson, when we got there, had left, and nobody knew where the equipment was. Now, I wasn't a happy camper at this point. This was my 4th, and not to mention my final trip. I had had enough. I then asked to see the store manager, who told the other salesperson to do whatever it took to solve my problem. First, I told the manager that I'm leaving my equipment with them and they can make the 2-hour round-trip journey themselves and bring it back to me. I also told the manager that I needed 2 connectors for the equipment. He said okay, he got them and charged me $6. Talk about adding insult to injury. I've had problems with this equipment for over a month. I've had to make 4 trips back and forth to solve this problem, and he's going to charge me $6? What would you do? I know if someone spent thousands of dollars with me and had so many problems, I wouldn't have the guts to think about charging them $6 for something. So after this, the sales manager tells me to call him the next day at noon so he can try to figure out where my replacement equipment was. Now wait a minute. I've spent all this money, spent all this time with these people, have had nothing but problems. Now he wants us to call him. It doesn't seem like they really know how to take care of the customer, does it? Now that brings me to another point, a point I want to share with you that I learned early in business. Now there are exceptions to every rule, and there is to this one, but I am a firm believer that if I am selling to you, I should be calling you. If you're selling something to me, or trying to, you should be calling me. That is what your profit is designed for. Work for your profit. You as a salesperson who profits or hopes to profit from the sale should be making the phone calls. Now, not every business requires a salesperson, obviously, to initiate the phone call, but where they should, they should. Now, I didn't need to be more aggravated by him wanting us to call him to see what they did wrong. That's his job as the merchant, not the customer's. That's what his company or his company's profit is designed to take care of, the legwork. That is by no means the customer's responsibility. So after leaving the store for the 4th time with my associate, do you think that we discussed this problem after we left? Oh, you bet we did. Do you think we told other people? You bet we did. And do you think they would have ever imagined that their story would have ended up in this program? You bet they didn't. You never know. Now, right before we left the store, here's something else that happened to top things off even further. Now, when you enter this store, you go through security, especially if you're going to be returning an item. So they sit there and they write all the information down on paper of what you're bringing back. It takes time from the customer and it really irritates them. Then when you leave, the paperwork you must go through and the hoops that you have to jump through is absolutely ridiculous. So as we were in line paying for our $6 item and waiting as we jump through all their hoops, a customer in front of us says, "I can't believe I have to go through all this just to buy one little item." And it was very obvious that he was not very happy. The girl behind the counter says, "Well, we try to make it as difficult as possible." He didn't think that was very funny. If those employees would just stop for a moment to think about what we might say about them and their company after we leave, and if they would focus truly on trying to put themselves in our shoes and really cared about the customer, I am convinced that they would have treated us differently. So after being at this store for several times, I've come to the conclusion that it's simply not worth going there again. An important thing to get from customers is also their feedback about your products or services. Now, I believe that there's a right way and a wrong way to do this. How do you get honest feedback from your customers? Well, of course, we have to ask them, but who should ask them? Not you. Why? The average customer will really not tell you the real truth. Most people don't feel comfortable telling you all the bad things unless they've really been pushed over the top. I'll tell you about a friend of mine that built a good-sized company with over 70 employees. Now, he had gotten to the point that he was losing a lot of business, and it seemed all happen at one time. He wanted to know what I thought he could do to stop this from happening. I told him first that he needed to find out why these companies were dropping his business. Now, he said that he would ask them, but they didn't seem to give him really solid answers. They gave him the same old, "Well, you know, your price is too high" type of stuff. I mentioned to him that his present and his past customers will not usually be completely open with him in most cases. So I offered to have my company call his new, his existing, and lost accounts. They told us everything. He couldn't believe it. He kept on saying, "They really said that to you? They never expressed that concern to me." It was amazing what his customers said, both good and bad, because they were expressing themselves to a third party. Now, after interviewing many of his clients, we were able to hone in specifically on what the company needed to do to keep from losing more business. He implemented a plan and turned things around very, very quickly. Now, he would not have been as effective if he had maybe his managers make the phone calls. They were too close to the clients. He needed somebody in a third-party situation. The third party is the trick to the effectiveness of this in many cases. You can have a qualified friend make some calls for you. Maybe your friend can say that they're doing a marketing survey for your company. You'll want to design a questionnaire that will help you find the answers that you're looking for. You might have questions like, what was the service like, or the quality, the turnaround time, whatever would apply, of course, you know, in your business. Now, you would have your customers rate the answers maybe with a scale of 1 to 10. The number 10, of course, would be the highest. And if the number isn't a 10 on the evaluation, we would want to ask them, what would the company have to do to receive a higher rating or even a 10? You can get an incredible amount of information from your customers and really learn what your customers are experiencing by purchasing your product and what's happening after. It's a great way to hone in on making your product and your service better. Here's another point to consider if you have employees. Have you ever been to a business or an establishment and the employees are making fun of or saying rude or derogatory things about a customer that maybe just called or recently left the store? After hearing all this, what's going on in your mind? I wonder what they're going to say about me when I leave. Employees should not be talking or saying negative things about customers in front of the customers or behind their customers' backs. It's poison to your customers. I used to belong to a gym and there was a lady there that just couldn't open her mouth without complaining about this customer or that customer. It was constant. She was so unprofessional that I actually had my friends tell me that they had bad experiences just from calling and wanting to get some costs on joining the gym, and they found out that she was just so rude to them just over the telephone. People in the gym would always be talking to each other when she wasn't around, saying that she was such a little wine bag. That was bad for business. I truly believe that that company could double their business if it weren't for that negative influence. When your employees or associates are on the job working with customers, teach them to be on stage. That's what Disney teaches their cast members. No, they don't call them employees. They teach them that once they get out on the company grounds, they are actors or cast members. They're to smile, be pleasant, and make everyone feel at home. What a lesson that can be learned from this, don't you think? So we don't complain to our customers about how bad our day is or how bad yesterday or today is going to be. We don't talk about how rude or how mean our boss is. We have problems at home, we keep them at home. Communicating with customers and talking with them is so vitally important in business. You know, I've learned a very unique way of communicating with customers from one of my mentors. When his staff walks by his customers, they are told not to just say hi or how are you. They are trained to ask things or say things that get the customer involved. Questions that need more of a response than fine, how are you, fine, thanks, and you. They ask things like, where are you from? What a beautiful outfit. Where did you get it? Are you enjoying your stay? Are you being treated all right? See the difference from the normal, hi, how are you? This takes some thinking on your part. Try to think of as many ways as you can start a conversation with a customer other than, hi, how are you? It takes some work. So try to use this technique. You'll find it's a very creative way to develop a rapport with someone. I would make every effort and try hard to develop good relationships with my clients when I opened my jewelry store. Now, one of my mentors also happened to be one of my clients. He would come into my jewelry store, and he noticed from time to time that we would cut down our competition. He told me and taught me to never do that. You know, in fact, even till this day, if I dare think about cutting down the competition, I immediately think about what he taught me. And you know, I feel so much better as a person when I don't do that. How about you? Do you or your fellow associates cut down the competition when talking with a customer? If you do, stop. Now, we might feel it makes us look better, but it comes across the same way when we cut another person down. It doesn't make us look any good, and it certainly doesn't elevate us anymore. If anything, it accomplishes just the opposite. We don't have to resort to cutting down the competition to convince a customer that we have a better product or service. Now, when I got into the jewelry business, we had developed a technique to repair gold chains that literally blew the competition away when it came to quality. So when a customer came in and they were considering having their gold chain repaired by us, I would have a gold chain that was repaired by another jewelry store. I would simply pull out that chain and I would show them the quality that they could expect from other jewelers. Then I pulled out one of our chains and they could actually see the comparison and the difference in quality. It was a major difference. But I didn't have to say to the customer, look at the quality of so-and-so's work. Oh, all the work they do is bad. They don't even know what in the world they're doing. It's pure junk. I wouldn't go to them if my life depended on it. Hey, customers are smart. They pick up on that and it usually ends up hurting us in the long run instead of helping us. Simply put, don't cut down your competition. Another thing that my billionaire mentor taught me was to really understand the needs of your customers, their feelings, and their complaints. He has thousands and thousands of customers daily, which means he has no choice but to have complaints. How does he handle them? He has his customer service department overnight these complaints to his office where he personally views them. He's looking for trends. Now, there are customers that all they like to do is complain just to complain, but he's really looking for legitimate complaints that regularly come up, and then he works on solving the problem quickly. Quite challenging when you have over 5,000 employees who are prone to all making mistakes, and sometimes they have bad days too. There's also a thought that my billionaire mentor does not subscribe to. It's a thought that in the last years that I've really learned to remove from my thinking because a company can't grow with it. The sad thing is that most small business owners subscribe to this philosophy. Perhaps you have, or you still are. If you want something done right, do it yourself. Have you said that one before? This statement is a death sentence to those who really want to grow their business. Granted, there may be a lot of truth in this statement, but how in the world can you grow a business if you're expected to do everything yourself because you want it all done right the way you want it done? There is only one you, and you are completely limiting yourself if you reward this thought. Here's the real challenge, though. How do we change this thinking? Common sense tells us that if we grow our company, the people that we hire are going to make mistakes. Mistakes that we wouldn't make, but we can't supervise everything if we have lots of employees. Not to mention that you might at times have to sacrifice some quality due to the fact that your associates may not care about the company as much as you do or your product. Now, you have to accept this if you want your company to grow. There is no way around this. So we basically have two choices: stay small or never grow, or accept the fact that the people that you hire may not be as caring, as skilled, as professional, and whatever it is that you're afraid of, that they won't do right. By learning how to let go some of this control, a small company can go from tens of thousands of dollars in revenue to millions and millions of dollars. My billionaire mentor can't attain his financial goals on his own. Does he have customer complaints? Of course he does. The more customers he attracts, the more complaints he's bound to have. That's simply the price that one must pay if they want to grow and let others be a part of their company. Now keep in mind that this billionaire mentor is hands-on, and he knows and he studies the complaint trends, and he works very hard to solve those problems. Now, wouldn't you rather have that problem than limit yourself and your business by thinking that if you want something done right, do it yourself? Because you want it done right all the time means that you're probably going to have a very, very small business and probably not much of a life. In other words, you'll probably have your business run you instead of you running it. Now, I have to admit that this lesson is one that I still have to keep check on. Let me share with you how I do this. The next time you ask one of your employees to complete a task and they mess it up, don't try to take over and step in if you can by all means prevent it. And be sure not to say to yourself, if you want something done right, do it yourself. You've got to break this habit, this way of thinking. Let this thought go and watch your business grow. You know, once you let go of this thinking, it's easy to see how a company could grow. Unfortunately, as companies grow, they set a lot of rules and a lot of red tape follows. Often the red tape and the rules ultimately end up hurting who? The customer. I'll give you a typical example. Not long ago, I flew some of my clients to the islands, and we went down there to spend just the day in the sun, and we wanted just to have a good time together. I had already paid the resort in advance and confirmed with them about 5 times that they had received my payment and they know that we were coming. And they basically have 2 programs. If you visit during the daylight hours, you can pay 1 fee per person, which covers everything at the hotel from breakfast to about 5 p.m. Now, during your stay at this time, you are required to wear a colored band on your wrist. Now, if you care to stay after 5 p.m., you have to pay more money, which includes dinner and entertainment, you know, way late into the hours. You have to exchange your wristband after 5 p.m. and get another color so that you can be identified as having paid for the events in the evening. So we paid for both. We arrived at 9 a.m. and we got our bands put on. So we left the hotel for several hours, then we came back after 5 p.m. Now, before we can enter the hotel, we need to have our day color bands cut off and replaced with new evening ones. All 10 of us are at the lobby now. I tell the girl at the counter that we need to exchange all of our bands. She looks at her paperwork and says that I have no information on you. Now, I asked her to figure it out as soon as possible. Now, why do you think I told her to do that? Well, I've got paying clients waiting in a lobby for a stupid wristband. It irritated me even more when I know my office had contacted them at least 5 times to confirm everything. Now, you already know how important customers are to me, and for me to have mine sitting in a lobby wasting time, especially when we're just down at this resort for the day, that time should be spent having fun, not waiting around in the lobby. As I'm asking the lady behind the counter, who has seen me several times there before, to hurry up, she tells me that she can't find our record of payment and now she'll have to find her supervisor. Oh, I really started losing it. I said to her, "Do you think that I would fly down here and then lie to you and make this all up?" I said to her, "Forget finding your supervisor, take my credit card and I'll pay for it all over again and let's do it now." I then told her that she wasn't allowing me to take care of my customers, which is now reflecting on her and her company. I said, "Why can't you just give us our evening bands, and if I'm wrong, come get me and I'll pay for it then." Do you see what I was trying to do? I was trying to keep my clients from waiting. She said that she couldn't do that. Her supervisor would have to approve it. Now, after all that, I had to pay them again, and we finally got our new wristbands. Now, some of you might think, "Gary, why would you pay that again? That's stupid." In my opinion, it wasn't foolish to pay again for 2 reasons. One, I would have just taken it off my credit card when I got back home. Second, and most important, the comfort and the happiness of my clients meant a lot more to me than having the hassle of repaying the hotel again and knowing that I would remove it off my bill sooner or later. Of course, I got a phone call the next morning when I got in my office from her supervisor apologizing about the problem. But what should the lady behind the counter have done? Why didn't she accommodate me? There was a stupid rule that she had to follow that ended up hurting their reputation. I have to get this approved from the supervisor, she says. Now, she's only doing her job, and I respect that. She's following rules or policies. One of my mentors taught me to teach my employees that sometimes it's okay to break or bend rules in the spirit of keeping our customers happy. That's exactly what this woman should have done. It was too obvious to her that I was legit. I wasn't pulling her leg. So we waited and we waited. Don't design your company in such a way that you have so many rules and policies and needed approvals that you forget what it means to take care of and make your customers happy. Sometimes you have to break the rules. You might catch some slack for it, but remember, it's usually easier to get forgiveness than permission. Don't abuse this one, but don't forget, it is usually easier to get forgiveness than permission. If this lady would have broken the rules for us to keep me and my clients happy, her supervisor, if she knew what it meant to put the customer first, would have understood her reason for breaking the rules. Forgiveness should have been very easy to have gotten from her supervisor. Another area in which I've observed that small business owners really limit their potential is thinking that they have some major secret and the entire world is out to find out whatever it is that they do. They won't teach anyone else their craft or skill because they are afraid that the person or the people that they're going to teach will leave them and start up their own business and or compete against them. Yes, that possibility does exist. But again, we have two choices. Let go of this type of thinking and limit our growth, or grow. It's really a bit silly when you stop and think about it, isn't it? Now, I used to think this way. In the jewelry trade, there are lots of secrets and techniques that I could have kept all to myself. I finally learned to quit thinking this way, and by letting go, I allowed my business to grow. I got tired of trying to do everything on my own. That got old very quick. If you think this way, stop for a moment and ask yourself, whatever my skill or job is there someone else out there in the world that does what I do? The answer is probably yes if you don't let your ego get in the way. Don't start saying yes, but they're not as good as I am. Maybe not. But they might have a bunch more money than you. Back to that illustration we spoke of earlier about the two artists. One who was incredibly talented and the other who isn't quite so talented but does so much more in business because they know how to market their product better. It all boils down to a choice, one or the other. I prefer the other. Just about all the people I trained to be a jeweler are to this day still in the business. Now, at first, that used to really bother me. But some time ago, over 15 years after teaching an employee about the business, I got a phone call from this gentleman, and he sincerely thanked me for teaching him the trade. I passed on knowledge to him that caused him to make a great living. I appreciated the fact that he took the time to call me and express how he felt. You know, one thing you can't be if you adopt these two last thoughts is a visionary. You simply can't paint a big picture or a vision by yourself. All my mentors have an incredible ability to look ahead and paint a big picture. Not the pie-in-the-sky stuff, but reality. When their minds are set, they don't stop or allow little things, or big things for that matter, to get in their way. They hold on to the dream and they march forward. Now, one thing I've also noticed that my millionaire mentors have in common is that they don't talk a lot of trash. They don't just babble and say, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that. When they tell you about a goal that they're going to pursue, rest assured that they're going to follow through on it. And sometimes you hear people say, oh, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that. They just carry on with no substance. They are dreamers without a vision. My millionaire mentors dream with a vision and hold on to it. They are not irrational optimists. Let's spend some time talking about irrational optimism. Interesting words, are they not? I guess you could say it's a sense of euphoria that some people get about a product or an idea that they have. I have met so many people like this. They have some product or idea that they come up with, and they think that everybody in the world is going to want it. Then they go on to tell you that all they have to do to make $1 million is sell 10,000 of them. That's all. That's all. Yeah, right. Now, you really don't want to burst their bubble, but selling 10,000 of anything nowadays is not that easy. They become irrationally optimistic because they think everyone is going to be as excited about their product or idea as they are. Now, individuals like Henry Ford and Walt Disney and others like them were not irrational optimists. They knew they weren't because every day they did something about their vision. They started bit by bit moving forward toward their goals every day, every month, and every year. Now, I doubt that either one of these men could have imagined how large their empires would have grown, but one thing they both had in common was the ability to have and dream a vision. People who are prone to being caught by the irrational optimistic bug are usually those who come up with an idea and just talk about and say how great it is. Often they expect someone to just drop the investment capital in their laps and say, hey, go ahead and continue with your project. They don't usually do what Ford and Disney did. Every day they did something toward attaining their goal. They also saw the practicality of their projects. For some people, their irrational optimism stems from their pride or ego. They just can't accept the fact that someone would not like their idea or invention. After all, it was their brilliant idea. Unfortunately, many of their friends feed the frenzy. This person shares the idea with their friends, and their friends mean well, and they don't want to hurt their feelings, so they tell them that the idea is great, or it's neat, or cool, and all that other stuff. We have to learn to be realistic. We must draw a line between being a visionary and an irrational, optimistic person. Develop patterns of following through on your plans and ideas. This way, you and the people around you will know that you're serious about your goals. Now, coming up with some lame brain ideas every week doesn't do that for us. It's a sign of irrational optimism. The problem with irrational optimism is that it makes a person too emotionally involved in a product. They can't accept the fact that their product or idea isn't really very marketable. Another thing one of my mentors taught me was to never get emotionally involved when it comes to things like purchases. I guess he had to bring that to my attention because it was a real weakness of mine. I always wanted a fancy car, the new home, and I would always go overboard. I would pay whatever price and jump whatever hoops I had to get whatever it is that I wanted. Sometimes I would go to my mentor in all my excitement and I'd show him a picture of what I wanted, or I took him along with me to see what I was drooling over, and I would do everything in my power to convince him that this purchase was a great deal. My excitement was a dead giveaway. He knew that I was so emotionally involved, hook, line, and sinker. So after I'd tell him how great of a deal this would be, he would always say the same thing. And here it is. You'll want to remember this the next time you get emotionally involved in thinking that you have to have this or you have to have that right now. He would say, there will always be another good deal. Let me repeat that. There will always be another good deal. Makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? And you know he's right. There will always be another good deal. Now, it takes a measure of maturity to believe this and accept this and move on. I used to buy stupid and non-essential things years ago because I first purchased the product in my mind and then I just had to have it. Now, if I want to buy something and I really don't believe it's the right move or not the right time financially, I can easily say there will always be another good deal. And when I say this, I truly believe it. What a difference it makes. I'm sure you've had the feeling before of being so excited about wanting to buy something that you couldn't even sleep at night. You tossed and turned trying to figure out how you would get the money to buy this. Now, you didn't want to admit it, but way in the back of your mind, you knew that it probably wasn't the smart thing to do. Once you realize that there'll always be another good deal, you'll sleep a lot better.